Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is another episode of The Grueling Truth. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster. We had a guest scheduled for tonight, Gary Jeter. Just texted him. He's having a hard time getting into the show. We don't know what kind of technical difficulties that's going on right now. So as soon as we can get that straightened out, we'll have him on the show, hopefully tonight. My co-host, Matt Andrew Scavage, I know you're pumped up about the show tonight, aren't you, Matt?
Very much so. Definitely looking forward to getting his perspective.
Well, I figured we would go ahead and just talk. I wrote an article that got a fair amount of views about the six men who should not be in the pro, or who I believe should not be in the Pro Hall of Fame. I know you read the article. I know you probably got some agreements, some disagreements. What were your thoughts on the article?
I agreed with pretty much every selection you had there. I mean, there's probably more that could have gone into the list, but you had only six, so there's only obviously so many you can put in there. But as I was reading it, really felt the same way, especially about your number one selection.
Yeah, number one, Joe Namath, which, I mean, he won one big game, which I don't even think he was probably the third or fourth vote for the MVP if they actually went with the guys that, I mean, had the biggest impact on that game. I mean, Matt Snell, I think, ran for 121 yards. I know Randy Beverly intercepted a couple passes. And I think it was George Sauer caught like seven or eight balls for 120, 130 yards.
Exactly. You watch Super Bowl III, you could really make the argument that he's not even the most valuable player of that game, and that's his signature game that really put him in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. And, I mean, if you look at him, you would – because this – my thought was – I didn't think his career was good enough to be in the Hall of Fame just from what I knew about him. But I didn't know that I would have him at number one until I looked at his stats, and you see that actually in 1968, which was their Super Bowl year, he threw 15 touchdown passes and 17 interceptions, which, I mean, it also shows you just how good the rest of that Jets team was around him. But most of his years, I think for his career, he threw like 40 more interceptions than he did touchdowns.
Exactly. Even when you take his career matched up against his peers in the way the game was played of his day, he's pretty far down on the list. And that was a very pass-happy league. Just doesn't seem to have what it takes to measure up, especially when you're talking about the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and you're talking the AFL back then, so it's not like they're predominantly running the ball. But for his career, 173 touchdowns, 220 interceptions, 27,000 yards. His career completion percentage was 50.1%. His quarterback rating was 65. I mean, that's less than Andy Dalton by about 10 to 15 points.
Yeah, exactly. And, I think it's always very, when it comes to statistics of that day, you know, we're obviously, I think you would agree with me, we're not talking about taking the stats that we find in the 1960s and comparing them with what we see today. No, it's about comparing what we saw in the 1960s compared to other quarterbacks that he played with. And he's still just so far down. And didn't he have
and
like
people
less
to
than
want to say, well, he won a chip, and the people to say he won a Super Bowl in the playoffs for his career. He got them to the playoffs twice. Played three games, threw three touchdowns, four interceptions, and had a completion percentage of 42.7. His career quarterback as an NFL quarterback was 68-71.
Yeah.
So my question to you would be this. If we were to take him out, who would you put in?
If we were to take Joe Namath out of the Hall of Fame, who would we put in?
The one quarterback that you think stands at the top of guys that should be in.
Oh, boy. That's a good question. All right off the top of my head here. quarterback that belongs in the Hall of Fame right off the top. I think you're going to like me. I'm going to go Ken Anderson. He's the first guy that comes to my mind that belongs in the Hall of Fame. That's not there.
Yeah, you compare their records. They played it close to the same time. I mean, Anderson's rookie year was 1971. Led the league in passing four times, back-to-back twice. Set the completion record for a season at a little over 70%. And in his playoffs, I know you did an article that I think had Kenny Anderson's career playoffs in there, or you checked out at some point how his passer rating was like 100 in all but like one or two games that he played in the playoffs.
Right. When you look at Kenny Anderson's career, the article that I wrote was the top five quarterbacks that do not have a championship ring. I had Kenny Anderson in there, I believe, at number three. And when I went through his career, I found that he had a playoff rating of over 100 in every single game up until he met Joe Montana. And basically, when you take in his passing titles, you take in the context of the way the game was played when he played. Quarterbacks were not completing 65% of their passes. It was a style of game. And so for him to be able to put up the numbers that he did and lead the league in passing four times, incredible. Taking his entire career, definitely belongs in the Hall of Fame, especially when you match it up with some guys that are already there.
Yeah. Now, here's another one that I had a major problem with that I didn't realize I did until I started looking up his career stats. And that's the only kicker, I believe, in the Hall of Fame, which is Jan Stenerud. I mean, Jan Stenerud, if you look up his numbers, he connected on 64% of his field goal attempts and 96% of his extra points. And people will say, well, he played a different time, kickers weren't as good. In comparison, though, when Stenerud was released by the Chiefs, he was replaced by Nick Lowry, who over the next 14 years as a Chiefs kicker hit on over 80% of his field goal attempts and 99.2% of his extra points. And, I mean, the other thing people bring up is the fact that, well, he helped the Chiefs win Super Bowls. But I believe he cost the Chiefs more chances to win Super Bowls than he helped them win. I mean, you remember the longest game ever played, the 71 divisional playoff game, where I believe he missed an easy 28-yard field goal at the end of the game, which would have won them the game and sent him to the championship game. And then in overtime, he gets a kick block.
Exactly. As you were talking, that was the game that came to my mind. The longest game. He missed critical field goals that, you know, quite frankly, that Chiefs team could have gone back to the Super Bowl, but he was the one that cost them. So I'd agree. I don't know how you look at his numbers. You know, sometimes these guys just get in strictly because of longevity.
Yeah, and if you look at him, I mean, for his career, he made 66.8% of his kicks, which ranks him 99th. And, I mean, there's kickers that, I mean, Adam Vinatieri should be a slam dunk. That'll let him in right now if they've got Jan Stenerud in right now.
Oh, yeah, and I completely agree also with, you know, the guy that you brought up right after him is Nick Lowry. Nick Lowry was a great kicker.
Yeah, no doubt he was. He didn't win a Super Bowl, though. Even though that Super Bowl they won was, what, 24-7, so I don't think the field goal kicker was much of the reason why they won that Super Bowl.
No, not at all.
My next guy was George Preston Marshall. George Preston Marshall was the Washington Redskins owner. I originally had Dan Dierdorf in this, which is what got me in contact with Gary Jeter. We were friends on Facebook. He saw the story. And he sent me a message about how crazy I was because Dierdorf was a beast and Dierdorf should be in the Hall of Fame. So we ended up, his uncle Bobby, he brought up, had played for the Packers. So I started looking in, and he said his uncle Bobby belonged in there before a bunch of guys. And I started looking it up, and his uncle Bobby was a great player. And I ended up writing a story about him, but I talked to Mr. Jeter for a good 3 hours about two Saturday mornings ago. And just the way he talked about Dan Dierdorf made me rewrite my article. And you know how hard it is to get me to admit that I was wrong, too, Matt. We've known each other for a while.
Absolutely.
So I rewrote it.
Monumental feat.
Yeah. But then the thing that made me switch it to George Preston Marshall is I wrote an article about Kenny Washington, who was the first African-American player basically to play in the more modern NFL in the 40s. And when I looked up George Preston Marshall, my problem with him was he had a quote when they asked him why he wouldn't sign black players in the early 30s. Because from the start of the NFL up to about 1926 or 27, black players did play in the NFL. It wasn't prevalent. It was only probably four or five guys that were allowed to play. And then all of a sudden it stopped in 1927 or 28. And what I found out was the reason it stopped was George Preston Marshall putting pressure on the other owners to basically outlaw him. And the quote that stuck out to me was the fact that he said, "We'll start signing Negroes when the Harlem Globetrotters start signing whites." And
right.
He was also, in 1962, he became the last NFL owner to sign an African-American player. And it was forced by Robert F. Kennedy, who was the attorney general at the time. And RFK basically issued an ultimatum at the time that made if Marshall didn't sign a black player, then the government would revoke the lease on the brand-new stadium the District of Columbia had built him. That's the only reason he then was forced to allow African-American players on his team.
Right. Yeah, at first glance, when I read your article, I never liked the idea of denying somebody what they're due based on something that goes on off the field or maybe a viewpoint that they have. But, as I read this more, I can see your point on this. I mean, this is, this is kind of a D-bag thing to, a viewpoint to take.
I don't know if we could say D-bag on the air. Is D-bag a curse word? but really, the way
D-bag.
I look at it is this. I mean, what he did, though, changed the landscape of professional football. I mean, he kept actually people from being able to play just because of the color of their skin. So, I mean, when you look at it, there was a lot of guys denied the chance to be NFL Hall of Famers. Guys like Kenny Washington, who I wrote about, who when he got out of college in 1941 had played with Jackie Robinson, was a great football player. He had to wait 6 years, and once again it was the pressure because Los Angeles, the Cleveland Browns were coming in to the AAFC, and Paul Brown was a legend in Ohio State, Columbus, and the Cleveland Rams were in effect as the NFL team. When the Browns came in, they actually moved before the AFC opened with the Browns because they didn't want to compete with them. But when they went to L.A., the reason they signed Kenny Washington is a lot of the public put pressure on him to sign black players. So,
right.
I mean, I think George Preston Marshall was worse than a D-bag. But you got one for me? I know you got one for me. That's a Green Bay Packer. If your dad's listening, he's going to totally agree with you.
Well, a long time ago, after Terrell Davis had retired, I'll give you a little bit of the background on this. Basically, when I was younger, the standard by my father for somebody making the Hall of Fame is they had to be great a long time. If I ever liked a player, basically what was said was, well, let's see what they do in 8 more years. And so that was always what was in my mind. You had to be great for a long time. Well, Terrell Davis had a fantastic career, though it was short. And I do think he belongs in the Hall of Fame. So in making the argument for Terrell Davis to be in the Hall of Fame, I began to take a look at players that had short careers that are in the Hall of Fame. And one of them I came across was Paul Hornung. Paul Hornung was drafted, I believe, in 1957 or 58. Was not very good. Had a decent year in 1959. But then in 1960, he set the scoring record, which I believe was for 286 points, that was broken by LaDainian Tomlinson in 2006. And he scored those points because he was a field goal kicker. He was a running back. He caught balls out of the backfield. He had a lot of opportunities to score. which is great. And then in 1961, he was the league MVP. But after 1961, he gets injured in 1962. He gets suspended for gambling for the entire season in 1963, has an average 1964. Doesn't really do much in 65, except there was a game, I believe he had 5 touchdowns, and then he did score in the Mud Bowl 65 championship game. So he did have a couple of good games there. But then in 66, he retires. And that's his career. It's basically 3 seasons. But he's in the Hall of Fame. So I think if Paul Hornung belongs in the Hall of Fame, I think Terrell Davis belongs in the Hall of Fame.
Well, there is no comparison, if you ever watched him, between Terrell Davis and Paul Hornung. And, I mean, Paul Hornung, even in college, I still believe he's the only player in the history of NCAA football to win the Heisman Trophy on a losing team at Notre Dame. And at the same time, Jim Brown, I believe, was at Syracuse, wasn't he?
Yeah, Jim Brown belongs or deserved that Heisman Trophy that year.
Well, there was like 20 guys that deserved it over Paul Hornung.
Right. You know,
and then
Paul
throw in the gambling
also. He wasn't a good player. Yeah, then throw in the gambling. But, you know, it isn't to say he wasn't a good player. He was important to the Lombardi Packers, important piece of the Lombardi Packers. He was a good blocker for Jim Taylor. And he would occasionally kick field goals. People bring up his field goals. You bring up Jan Senner, look up Paul Hornung's numbers. It was really lousy percentage-wise with the field goals. He was not a good kicker. You know, he could do a few things that people call him the versatile one. You know, and he was, but I don't think he's Hall of Fame worthy if Terrell Davis isn't. There are some guys that I think belong in over him. You know, it took him a very long time to get in the Hall of Fame. He actually had to write a letter to the NFL Hall of Fame in order to get in. So, you know, that isn't to say he wasn't a good player, but he'd probably be one that I'd leave off for a few other guys.
Well, and the next one would be my head coach that I don't believe belongs in the Hall of Fame, which would be Marv Levy. Marv Levy, I mean, with the Kansas City Chiefs, was 31-42, was absolutely abysmal. Then went on to the Buffalo Bills, went to 5 AFC championship games, played in 4 Super Bowls, lost all 4 Super Bowls. For me, for a head coach, you get in by either winning championships or by being innovative. And he did not win Super Bowls. He was not innovative. His greatest invention, of course, you know, I'm a Bengals fan, so you know I'm going to bring this up. His greatest invention was to come up with the no-huddle offense 2 years after the Bengals spanked him in the AFC Championship game with it. And then on top of that, if you look at the teams that he beat to win AFC Championship games, the Miami team in 92, you know, you had 91, you had Denver, which I believe without John Elway getting hurt, they come back and win that game. I mean, that's a 10-7 game in the last minute. I think Kubiak threw an interception at around the 50-yard line. I'm pretty sure Elway probably gets them in at least field goal range. You had 90. They beat the Raiders without Bo Jackson. Yeah. So, I mean, what's your thoughts on Marv Levy?
Well, okay. I am a Marv Levy fan because I very much like that Bills team of the early 90s. They were one of the most exciting teams I've ever watched. But, you know, he kind of had, unfortunately for Marv Levy, they never won it. They never could win the big game. I do agree the level of competition that he played was not very good. Probably that Miami team in 92 was the best one, and it was on the road. But overall, you know, yeah, it is hard to argue. I mean, I guess the only question I'd have for you is, does Bud Grant deserve the Hall of Fame? Does Marty Schottenheimer? I mean, obviously, Marty Schottenheimer didn't even get close. But, you know, what are your thoughts on, like, Bud Grant?
My thoughts on Bud Grant are this. He went to 4 Super Bowls, and he got beat by far superior teams all 4 times. His Vikings, I mean, you got to remember this with Marv Levy. I mean, they were in the playoffs about 6 or 7 times, but Grant was in the playoffs every time for about 20 years, I think. And with Marv Levy, three of those teams were superior to his teams. He had the better team against the Giants. The Giants outcoached them. They controlled the clock. They won the game. If he wins that
right.
game, he's in the Hall of Fame. Heck, Thurman Thomas is probably in the Hall of Fame. And then I would agree with Jim Kelly being in the Hall of Fame.
That is the real bar, because it comes down to the kick.
Hey, that's life, though. When you're the better team, it shouldn't come down to a kick. And, I mean, if you look at the Giants had Jeff Hostetler and Otis Anderson, who was 106 years old. I mean, he was rookie of the year in 1939, I think. But, I mean,
Thurman Thomas
should have
gotten MVP of that game.
Yeah, he would have gotten the MVP of that game. At least I think he would have. You never know. They
Definitely.
Like to give it to the quarterback. So, but and my problem, my biggest problem with a Marv Levy or a Don Coryell being in the Super Bowl or being in the Hall of Fame is the fact that one of the greatest coaches that ever lived, who was innovative, who was groundbreaking, is Tom Flores, and nobody even considers him when they're voting for the Hall of Fame. Tom Flores won two Super Bowls. He won a Super Bowl as a player, as backup quarterback to Lynn Dawson. He won Super Bowl XI as an assistant coach to John Madden. He won two Super Bowls with the Raiders. And the thing that drives me nuts is people say, well, he didn't really coach the team Al Davis did. If that's true, why is John Madden in the Hall of Fame? He only won
one.
Was half as many. And the thing is this. If Al Davis was why they won those Super Bowls, Tom Flores last year, I think, was 1986 or 87. They haven't won a Super Bowl since, and Al Davis was alive for 22 of those years after that. And then
right.
the other argument I always hear was he played with John Madden's guys. He didn't win with John Madden's guys. I mean, he
Not
had an
all.
Entirely different – I mean, he had Kenny King at running back. You had Jim Plunkett at quarterback. And the thing people remember is 1980's first Super Bowl, Jim Plunkett was not the starting quarterback until Dan Pastorini broke his leg against the Redskins in, like, week 4 or 5. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on Tom Flores?
Oh, anybody that, to me, you win two Super Bowls, how can you not be in the Hall of Fame? That just doesn't make any sense to me. There's not a lot of teams that have won two Super Bowls. I think it has something to do with the coach. you know, you look at, like you said, look at the teams that he played, the players that he played with or that he coached, you know. Jim Plunkett in 1983 was splitting time with Mark Wilson. You know, Marcus Allen he was the MVP of the league in 85. He had a good year in 83. You know, a lot of this has to be credited to the coach. To me, if you win two Super Bowls, you got to be a good coach. And so to put a coach in, even if I'm on the fence with a guy like Marv Levy, you have to put Tom Flores in before Marv Levy. Have to.
Well, and if you look at his career in the AFL, I mean, he was the first starting quarterback in Oakland Raider history. I think he started the first 5 years. He's still, and will always be, since the AFL is gone, the fifth leading passer in AFL history, and he's one of only 20 players who basically played every year of the AFL's 10-year existence. I mean, the first
that was
Hispanic.
The stat that really shocked me.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at the first
number
Hispanic
five
coach. Yeah, the first minority head coach, first minority general manager, first minority starting quarterback. I mean, there's so many firsts here. I mean, the thing I always hear is the argument about when you're going to put somebody in the Hall of Fame, the question should be, can the history of NFL football be written without this man? And I think it is clear and beyond doubt that it cannot be written without Tom Flores' name in it.
Completely agree. If that's a good standard, and you, like you said, all the things that were, he was first in, and the fact that he was also such a good player. I had no idea until we had talked about it that he played in the AFL. I just remember him coaching. And it's funny, you bring up the name Tom Flores to people. It's appalling that nobody even knows who he is. He was a good coach.
Yeah, it's an absolute – it's criminal. I mean, if you're going to be an NFL fan and not know who Tom Flores is, there's something wrong. I mean, the man was with the Raiders. He was a proven winner for over 30 years. I mean, yeah, he went to Seattle. Didn't go right there in Seattle, but they didn't have the players. I mean, stuff happens. But overall for his career, and we need to go back to this. You thought that was a good standard that you're in the Hall of Fame if they can't write the history of pro football without you, right?
Yeah, it's Marv Levy. You could write the history of football.
Yeah, you could write the history of pretty much anything without Marv Levy in it.
We've had so many of these discussions. I know right where you're going.
Hey, so what would be another one for you?
Oh boy, another one that does not belong. Oh, I really agreed with what you had about Lynn Swann.
Matt, keep talking. I got Gary Jeter on the line.
All right. I thought Lynn Swann definitely, he had a good career. Really, Super Bowl 10 was his signature mark. But, when you look at players like Drew Pearson, and I'd argue that a guy like Harold Carmichael for the Philadelphia Eagles is more deserving than a guy like Lynn Swann. For a couple of years.
Lynn Swann's career stat. Lynn Swann, 336 career receptions for 5,000 yards, 51 touchdowns. Drew Pearson, 489 catches, 1,000 yards. And, I mean, people talk about Lynn Swann made big plays in big games. Drew Pearson made just as many.
Yeah.
I mean, Drew Pearson was a great wide receiver. Harold Carmichael would be, he would be a great idea for a new story for you, wouldn't he?
Yeah, he's actually my, as I was doing a little research on what the next player I wanted to write about, Harold Carmichael really came to mind. That was a big man, really good player, doesn't get enough notoriety.
Yeah, he was the first really big wide receiver that I remember.
Yeah,
wasn't he like 6'4", 6'5"?
No, he was like 6'7", or 6'8". He was a giant man. And he could move like
that. So you got any more?
Okay, any more? Let's see here. Oh, who else did you have on your list here?
Frank Gatsky, which I didn't talk about Frank Gatsky because I figured probably nobody's ever heard of him outside of me. Well, hold on a second, Matt.
Yep.
You there, Gary?
I'm here.
All right, guys, we got Gary Jeter on the line. He was supposed to go in top of the hour. We had some technical difficulties with the Blog Talk Radio. He couldn't get in, but he's in now. How you doing? Welcome to the show, Gary.
I'm doing real good, man. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, no
Welcome,
problem.
Gary.
We've
it's
got
a
about
to have you on.
Yeah, we've got about 17 minutes left on the show. We got 2 minutes on the live show. If you're listening right now, if you wait till about the bottom of the hour at 12:30, an hour from now, you can get on in here the last 15 minutes of the show on archive time. But so let's see, Gary, you want to talk about your Uncle Bob? We wrote
sure,
a story,
man.
Or I wrote a story about him. I already told everybody the story of how we got on there. Where you got on me about the Dan Dierdorf thing, which, once talking to you, I changed that. So, your Uncle Bob, though.
Oh, you know what?
When I watched, huh?
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say, your Uncle Bob, when I watched that 59 Rose Bowl film, the guy was an unreal running back. And he was big for his time, too, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. You know, it was really surprising. It was the first time that I had seen my Uncle Bob play running back. I'd heard so much about that 59 Rose Bowl. He was the MVP. Up until, I believe, Charles White broke his record. He had the record for the longest run in the Rose Bowl and the most yards. Then he went to Canada to play pro ball, for a couple of years. He was a wide receiver. Then he ended up going to Green Bay Packers, and they said he couldn't catch a cold up in Green Bay, and they made him a defensive back. So, the interesting thing about it is that he became one of the, one of the all-time, great defensive backs, and was the, in a recent poll that was going, NFL Network, he Uncle Bobby and Herb Adderley were the number one tandem of all time in reference to defensive backs that ever played in the NFL. So, you know, our family was quite proud of that.
Well, and the other thing that I didn't realize when I was writing the story was Herb Adderley, and I think college, he came to the Packers as either a running back or a wide receiver also. And, I mean, Vince
exactly.
Lombardi had enough foresight to switch them both to corner.
Yes, well, you know, I'm not really sure what the whole story was with her, but as far as my uncle was concerned, my uncle had a hard time adjusting to wide receiver position when he was at Green Bay, you know, and, you know, they had Dale and Dowler up there.
Yeah, Max McGee.
Max McGee, you know, so they had some really great wide receivers there. And so it was really tough, you know. He was having a hard time to break in. So he put him on the defensive side of the ball, and it took him a while, a couple of years to adjust, but in the 1965 championship game against the Cleveland Browns, he played against Paul Warfield. And he did a great job against Paul Warfield and ended up taking over the starting job in that particular game. And, you know, pretty much the rest was history, man. He was an incredible defensive back, man. He was very instinctive. He was a sure tackler. It was kind of like, the Deion Sanders of his time. You know, he wasn't like a vicious hitter, but it was always a sure tackler. And for whatever the reason was, usually always ended up covering the toughest receiver on the other team.
Yeah. Matt?
Yeah, Gary, this is Matt. Really great to have you on the show.
Hey, my pleasure.
Great. Did your uncle ever tell you what it was like to play for Coach Lombardi?
You know what, we worked out a few times. You know, just said it was tough. You know, it was kind of like we weren't really. You know, he was more like I didn't grow up with my father, and so he was more like my father. So, you know, we didn't really talk about stuff like that. We just kind of talked about life in general. But I was always around. You know, I got a chance to meet Lombardi in 1966 at the College All-Star Game in Chicago. That's where I first met him personally and had a conversation with him. You know, at that time I was 11. And I could I was a different kind of kid, and I just kind of observed how Coach was and I observed the type of players that he had on his team. And actually, when I kind of picked up how Coach was, you know, these guys played a lot of cards, and they played a game called Bidwith, you know. And I used to just kind of – I was just hanging around, you know, just sitting – just listening, man, you know, for as long as he would let me listen. And, you know, you would hear the stories of Lombardi and how tough he was. And, you know, you had Willie Wood, you had Herb Adderley, you had Willie Davis, Lionel Aldridge. I mean, you know, he had some great guys, man, and they just bought into what he was selling, and it worked because prior to them coming there, to Coach Lombardi coming there, the Packers hadn't won in forever, and so you know it was kind of like, well, he came out of like my way, the highway, you know, and you know once the guys bought into it, I mean, you see the results that ensued afterwards.
Yeah, and the great thing about after I wrote the article is yesterday, I know I sent you a picture of the last comment I got from the Green Bay Packer Hall of Fame, but they sent me a message. They sent me a message and wanted to look into either putting the article either in the Hall of Fame or on the Hall of Fame's website. And I know that the man that runs, I guess, the Green Bay Packer Facebook page, he gets back on there, said he was forwarding it to Cliff Christie, the Packer staff historian. He said, thanks for the information. He said, I had a pleasure of meeting Mr. Jeter, and he was one of the most wonderful people I've ever met. Which, I mean, it's got to make you feel better than even the football part.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, Marco Bobby was a class act, man. He was a really sharp dresser. You know, he always had that really short haircut. He had the little part, you know, which was a classic in the early 60s, you know, 70s. And, you know, and it was kind of, you know, he talked a lot, but he kind of talked a lot in his own way. You know, he didn't really, you would never know that he was talking, but he kind of, he did it in a subtle way. But primarily, you know what, he led his talking, he led his ability on the field, really carry his way. You know, Herb Adley, Willie Wood, you know, they got most of the press initially in the backfield, and rightfully so. I mean, these guys were great players. And the Packers had so many great defensive players, as well as offensive players, that, you know, Marco Bobby was kind of like, he came in just, he was like the last piece of the puzzle. And it was right before their Super Bowl run. Because, you know, the Packers had, you know, they had gone to the championship game in 1960, 61, 62. And then they went 65, 66, 67. And so, you know, he kind of missed the first part. But the second part, he was integral in the success. And, he, you know, he started in the first two Super Bowls. And, you know, it was really interesting. I had a chance to play 13 years in the NFL, and I never went to a Super Bowl. And, you know, I look back, I remember the first two Super Bowl games. I mean, just like they were yesterday. And, you know, the Super Bowl back then was not a big deal. You know, and the Packers beat Kansas City and Oakland and beat them bad. Now when you look at the Super Bowl, it's almost like a national holiday. You know, so, I mean, you could see where, you know, in a relatively short period of time, man, it's just become a phenomenon, the Super Bowl, whereas back then, you know, it really wasn't the same game that it is today.
You know, you were saying how you talked a lot about life with your uncle. What were some of the best advice, especially when it came to your own NFL career, that you got from your uncle?
Well, you know what, it's just kind of, hey, you know, work hard, man. You know, he said cream, he always told me cream always rises to the top. You know, I think that was a big saying of his, you know, when we would work out. And, and that was the interesting thing. I had right when I was starting to play football, you know, his career was kind of ending. You know, I mean, I started like in 1969, I would have been like a freshman in high school. And he still had like a couple years left. And when he would come and see my mother, which is his sister, she always made, you know, this big yellow cake, man. He liked this yellow cake, man, with just plain white icing. And my mother was just a phenomenal cook as well as a phenomenal baker. And he would come through, and he'd stay a couple days. And this was before he had any kids. So I was, you know, I mean, he treated me, I was like his son. And, man, I was always so, you know, I was so happy to see him, man. And, you know, I would, like, you know, around the neighborhood, you know, the Browns, you know, I grew up in Cleveland, and the Browns were the big team. But I was never a Browns fan because of my Uncle Bobby. And so all the kids would say, oh, man, you know, that's Bob Jeter's nephew, you know. And that, like, that meant something, you know. So that was like, man, yeah, that meant something. So when he would come through, and, like, the kids in the neighborhood would see him, and then we would go work out. And we would go run in the park. We would just run in the park, man. And, and he would just say, you know, hey, he says, you know what? He says, set your goal. He says, set your goals high and work hard to obtain them. And, you know, and he didn't really, like, go over. He wasn't a yeller or a screamer. You know, maybe he saw something in me that at the time that I didn't know I had in me. Because, you know, I played baseball and I played basketball. I wasn't really a football player. You know, I was always too big for the little kids and too young for the older kids, you know. So, you know, I didn't start playing organized football until the ninth grade, and I wasn't very good. And, you know, and I wanted to quit because, you know, they didn't throw me the ball as a tight end. And on defense, I was like, man, what the hell am I doing over here, man? This seems like mass confusion. And, you know, one of the coaches came to me and says, hey, you know, you need to lift some weights. So I lifted the weights in the off season, man, and I grew to this, you know, put on like 35 pounds and 3 inches, and I was a little bit better, but I still wasn't any good. So then, you know, I was talking to my uncle the next year, and he was like, you know, stay with it, you know, just stay with it. And I was like, man, I really don't like this football thing. So then a funny thing happened. I could see myself getting better. And as a result of the work and listening to the lessons that were taught by my Uncle Bobby, also my Uncle Tony, which was his brother, and, you know, coaches, I started to see what they saw. And as a result, you know, pretty much the rest was history, man. It just, you know, the light went on, and I started understanding what football was all about. And then as the years went by, man, I just got smarter and smarter, bigger and bigger pretty much at the game.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you this. We've only got about 2.5-3 minutes left. You had a great career yourself, and if we wouldn't have had the technical difficulties that started the show, we'd have got into all of it. I mean, are you willing to come back here in the next week or two? We can talk about your career a little bit more in depth.
I tell you what, I would love to come back next week.
Next week? All right. We've got Leon Searcy, former Jacksonville Jaguar, Pittsburgh Steeler offensive lineman. It's supposed to be on next Wednesday night, but we're looking into hopefully adding a show Thursday or Friday. Would you like to be on that one?
Sure. I mean, you just let me know when, and I'll make sure I'm on.
All right. Now, I've got one other request. I don't know if you saw on Facebook where we posted the thing. There was a guy named Joe from New Jersey. His name's Joe Rodriguez. He's the biggest Giants fan I know, and he loved you when you played for the Giants. So just say hi, Joe, for me, and he'll be happy.
Hey, Joe, how you doing, man? I really appreciate your support, as well as the support, man. I want to say, I know we don't have much time, but I want to say one thing in closing. The Giants fans, man, are without question the best. I mean, there's the 6 years that I played here and the 6.5 years since I've moved back. I mean, you know, it's amazing how a lot of these guys are still around and they remember when I played with the Giants. And, you know, and even with all the success that they've had here, Wellington Mara, the former owner of the Giants, he had a saying that came to fruition. And he says, once a Giant, always a Giant. And it's amazing. After 20 years of really not being in this New Jersey area, I got transferred by my job. And so I came back up here to New Jersey. And I tell you, it was amazing. I said, nobody's going to remember who the heck I am. I mean, they've had so much success. They've won a couple Super Bowls. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, it was just a matter of time of getting around and meeting people, you know, seeing people. And I remember, if they didn't remember, they said, well, yeah, well, man, I remember you were my dad's favorite player. And, you know, to this day, it just makes me, you know, feel warm inside.
Well, it was great talking to you again, as it always is. We will try to set you up for next week. I'll be in touch within the next day or so to let you know. Matt, you got any closing comments?
I'm definitely looking forward to getting Gary back on the show. I would love to ask him about his career with the Giants and the Rams and even at USC. And Gary, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks a lot, Gary.
Okay, take care, guys. Talk to you next week.
Too.
Okay.
All right. All right. So he's a great interview. I spent 3 hours on a Saturday morning talking to him. He's got a lot of great stories. We got to figure out a way to get him on next week, Matt.
Definitely. He's definitely want to ask him about, his playing days, the miracle at the Meadowlands, the 85 championship game, a lot of great moments that he was a part of, and I would love to get his perspective.
But so, like I said before, next Wednesday night we'll have former Pittsburgh Steeler, Jacksonville Jaguar. He was a 1999 Pro Bowler, Leon Searcy, on the show. to talk about. He's doing some stuff with offensive linemen. He started a business with that and talk about his career. So we will see you guys next Wednesday on The Grueling Truth.